Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your call. Israel's general election is next Tuesday. The Guardian's Harriet Sherwood reports that Benjamin Netanyahu is on course to, quote, head a more hawkish and pro-settler government following Tuesday's elections, even though final opinion polls show a drop in the number of seats his right-wing electoral alliance is expected to win, end quote. Support has risen dramatically for the Jewish Home Party, whose platform is even more conservative than Netanyahu's, which in turn could create a further right-wing nationalist government in Israel. Joining us to talk about coverage of this is Nicholas Pelham. He has covered the Arab world for 20 years. He currently writes for The Economist and the New York Review of Books, and he's been covering elections in Jordan. And he joins us from Tel Aviv. Hi, Nicholas. Welcome to the show.
Hi, it's good to be with you. I'm in Jerusalem.
Oh, you're in Jerusalem.
So just back from Jordan, yeah.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for joining us. And we are also talking today about media coverage of internet pioneer and activist Aaron Swartz, who took his life tragically last week at the age of 26. He killed himself after the U.S. government charged him with computer fraud for using computers at MIT to download millions of academic articles provided by the nonprofit research service JSTOR and then distribute them freely to the world. He faced up to 35 years in prison. Joining us to talk about this tragic suicide, the implications, and where this goes from here is Trevor Aronson. He's co-director of the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting and author of the new book, The Terror Factory, Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terrorism. Hi, Trevor. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So Trevor, why don't we start off with you? Where did you see a good report this week?
Actually, the report I'm going to mention is a report that's gotten a ton of attention, and I think rightfully so, which is this Deadspin article on the Notre Dame player Manti Te'o and this hoax that he was either involved in or wasn't, involving a girlfriend who allegedly died tragically in a car accident. And the story was kind of lionized by the sports media as being kind of this tragic story of this great football player who played wonderfully despite this awful tragedy in his life. And I think it comes at a remarkable time. You know, right now the Lance Armstrong interview just occurred, and he admitted to doping. And, you know, now we have this other article that shows how, you know, the sports media, maybe unlike we see in the political press, is all too willing to kind of put the subjects on a pedestal and almost lionize them to some degree.
Yeah, the Chronicle actually had an op-ed this morning comparing these two, and I have to say, I've been somewhat, I don't know, surprised, I guess, by just the sheer amount of media attention to Lance Armstrong. And I thought, gosh, I wish they'd spend half as much time on things like military spending bills. I mean, do you think that his confession merits this much coverage?
No, but it becomes like a circus thing. And I think, you know, the media often is guilty of kind of, you know, following what the other media is doing. And, you know, I think this is the tragic thing, that we would spend a lot more time talking about Lance Armstrong when he was doing well, then we would talk about these other things, like you mentioned, like the story we're about to talk about in Israel, for example.
Right.
And I think, you know, the flip side to that is then when something bad happens, we end up spending even more time on that. So, you know, I think there's inherent media criticism in both, and, you know, in the amount of time we spend on these types of stories, as well as, you know, in the case of, you know, Manti Te'o, you know, the question of accuracy and how, in stories that are running in, you know, magazines like Sports Illustrated that are supposed to be vigorously fact-checked, how easily it seems for these stories that are full of errors to be put into the press and then, you know, repeated by other media members.
Yeah, well, Nicholas, this is what you're missing in the United States, wall-to-wall coverage of this Lance Armstrong confession.
I'm afraid I've been looking at more parochial matters here.
Yeah. Well, lucky for you. So what have you seen this week that you thought was done well?
It was actually a story that came out of the U.S. It was a small blog by Jeffrey Goldberg looking at Obama's reactions to the latest announcement for settlement construction by the Israeli minister in this parliament, and then the contender to be the next prime minister as well, the prime contender. and with Obama saying that he felt that Israel no longer what his best interests were under Netanyahu. And that had was seen as intervention in the Israeli elections and had huge political play here.
So since you brought up settlements, as I stated in the intro, The Guardian is reporting that Netanyahu is on course to head a more hawkish and pro-settler government following Tuesday's elections. There have been a number of reports about Netanyahu saying that no settlements at all will be dismantled. These are West Bank settlements during his next term in office. Can you talk a little bit about this? And is this any different from past policies?
It's not really different. But what we're seeing is a consolidation of the Israeli right over the political process in Israel, and right wing in Israel primarily means control over land, Jewish control over land, rather than. In other countries, it's focused more on distribution of national wealth. Here, it's on control over land, and you're seeing the right wing gain ever more consolidation over that land, to the detriment of the Palestinians and to the detriment of the prospect for a Palestinian state and a two-state solution.
And you know, it's interesting about the settlements. When this gets attention in the West, you might hear an administration, you heard it under the Bush administration, the Obama administration, that they oppose settlements. But you don't really get much detail about the settlements themselves and what this really means when you're talking about Palestinians, for example. The BBC has an article called Israel Election: Netanyahu Will Not Dismantle Settlements. And they did report that about 500,000 Jews live in more than 100 settlements built in the West Bank and East Jerusalem since Israel occupied the area in 67. The international community considers these settlements illegal, though Israel disputes this. Do you see much attention specifically just on the settlements and what this means in the international media?
I suppose that this is an area. It's an area, of course, which the international media has focused on extensively. What is surprising is that I think that this is also percolated down into Israel in this election as well, and that there's been an attempt by Netanyahu and by his the leader of the opposition to focus attention on the. On the economy, and from the right, and from to some extent from the center, the issue of what the future of Israel is going to look like, and where Israel's borders are going to be, has bounced right back into the public debate, and it's been a feature of this election campaign. So yes, both in the international media and in Israel, attempts to talk about. The economy of within Israel, by Netanyahu, talk about the economy have largely come to nothing, and it's been very much a focus on Israel's relationship with the Palestinians and how it's going to, if this right wing coalition gets back into power, which every opinion poll suggests that it will, how you're going to see a more sectarian, more chauvinistic Israel emerge as a result.
And that is Nicholas Pelham. He's covered the Arab world for 20 years. He currently writes for The Economist and the New York Review of Books. He's joining us from Jerusalem talking about the elections in Israel on Tuesday. He's also been covering the elections in Jordan. And he'll be with us for about 5 or 10 more minutes. So if you have any questions about this, we'd love to hear from you. What do you make of the coverage of these issues? Of course, with Chuck Hagel's nomination to become the Secretary of Defense, there's been so much coverage of his views on Israel. In fact, that's been dominating the discussion. But have you seen much attention on the elections and the settlements and the fact that, according to the BBC, the new Israeli government is expected to be one of the most right-wing in the country's history? What are your thoughts on the coverage of this? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Trevor, what do you make of the coverage of what you've been seeing, specifically about, you know, Chuck Hagel. I mean, so much of the media's attention on Chuck Hagel has been focused on where he stands on Israel. We talked about this last week.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just kind of a principle of faith among, you know, Republicans in particular, and also among many Democrats, that there has to be this steadfast support for Israel, and that if there isn't, then there's a question of, well, you know, what are your priorities as a defense secretary? And I think we've seen this outsized influence, you know, particularly among, you know, the more hawkish members of Congress, the people who are most interested in making sure that Israel remains a close ally. And I think, you know, what we aren't seeing is really questions of, you know, what we're just talking about here, whether, you know, the efficacy and of these settlements, and whether Israel should be building them, and whether the Obama administration should be questioning that and pressuring Israel not to do this. Instead, what we see is just, you know, there's kind of a race to show how much you support Israel. And I think ultimately that really colors any kind of discussion about how, you know, the American stance on the Middle East and foreign policy in particular.
And Nicholas, what are your thoughts on that? Just the fact that here in the U.S., so much of the media coverage surrounding Chuck Hagel's nomination has focused on Israel. Does this get much attention internationally and Israel?
It has. I think people also have been looking at Kerry's nomination. He's remembered here for and internationally for going to Gaza after not the last Gaza, Israeli bombardment of Gaza in last November, but the previous one in December 2008, January 2009, and expressing he went in immediately after and expressed shock over the siege on Gaza, and came out and asked the then Israeli Prime Minister why, of all things, Pastor wasn't allowed in. So I think, yeah, I mean, there is a sense that under Netanyahu, the relationship with the Obama administration is going to be more rocky. That it's not going to have the same degree of protection, perhaps, that it could rely on in the past, and particularly where there could be a key difference is that if there is criticism coming from other parts of the world, the U.S. will do less to intervene. What is bizarre is that in this Israeli election, that hasn't so far at least seemed to play to Netanyahu's seems to be a disadvantage. Indeed, Netanyahu's the main group is supporting it, and Netanyahu put Obama's criticisms on its front page. In an attempt to try and present Netanyahu as being a nationalist who could stand up to outside pressure.
And what about the reality on the ground and what this means for people on the ground whose lives have been affected by, for example, the Israeli assault on Gaza, and just how it plays out today? For example, between January 11th and January 15th, four young Palestinians aged 17 to 22 were killed by the IDF, members of the IDF, and this happened in the Gaza Strip and different points along the West Bank. There's an article in the Electronic Intifada called How the Media Let Israel Get Away with Murder by Charlotte Silver, and we just got an email from a listener on this. Do these deaths get much attention in the Israeli media?
No, they get very little. They don't get a huge amount in the Palestinian media either. They become almost kind of the background noise. If news is new, then this is nothing which is new. It's really part of the regular backdrop of Israel's continued conflict with the Palestinians and the ongoing occupation. I think what is significant is that you're seeing so the prime conflict over the last 6 years, most of the time that I've been here, has been with Gaza. What you're seeing is, to some extent, a stabilization of Israel's relationship with Gaza, and much greater focus on the West Bank as the area of conflict. This is the area where Israel's occupation and its construction of settlements of Jewish settlements has grown ever more intense. And this is an area where I think we can see the greatest focus when it comes to future conflicts between Israel and Palestine.
Well, and you, Nicholas, you've been covering this for 20 years. So how do you decide where to focus when these deaths happen on a fairly regular basis, if you really pay attention?
The pages that I write for tend to focus more on trends and developments rather than on headline news. So if they point to a new direction of the conflict, if they point to something to a new escalation, if they're likely to precipitate a new round of conflict, then there's something which I would focus on. If they if they're not going to precipitate, if it's more of the same, it's much harder to persuade my editors that this is something which is worth writing about.
Can you stay with us for a couple more minutes? We just have a few callers on this. Nicholas, can you stay with us for a few more minutes?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, great. Let's hear from GS in Richmond. Hi, GS.
Very good. Good morning. Thank you. I'm basically interested in the comments folks might make. I maybe have a bit of a cynical view about things. I'm appalled that Israel continues to, 500,000 people in the territory that they're occupying illegally according to international law, and that's the first thing. But the thing that really troubles me is that the United States is not putting a great deal more pressure on Israel to stop this sort of nonsense. And my suspicion is, and this is the cynical part, my suspicion is that, we sort of hold Israel to be a bastion of Western thought in the middle of the Far East, and I have a feeling that it has a lot more to do with our interest in the oil over there than anything else. Thank you.
All right, thank you. We'll get a comment in just a minute. Let's hear next from Sam in Santa Cruz. Hi, Sam. Hello, Sam.
Oh, hi. I'm sorry. I thought you were playing my comment already. Yes, I traveled to the Middle East many years ago, and at that time the United States was very well received by the Arab world, but as time has gone on, I think the United States, with their position of backing Israel no matter what, has shown the Arabs that the people of the Middle East, that we care very little about their lot. And, everything we're talking about, if you look back to 1948, we supported Israel so that Israel would be a wedge in the Arab world as far as their unification. And we have been supporting them no matter what ever since. They are the country with the largest weapons of mass destruction in Israel and indeed in the world behind France, the United States, and Britain.
You're talking about nuclear weapons?
Yes, exactly.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in. We'll get an email. We'll get a response in just a couple minutes. We also got an email about a Jewish Voice for Peace rally in D.C. to hold Washington accountable for providing Israel with $3 billion in military aid every year. Nicholas, joining us from Jerusalem, were you able to hear our callers?
I heard some of it. I think I got the gist. I didn't hear every word.
Okay, so basically it's the U.S. putting more pressure on the Israeli government. What are your thoughts on that? And just also, does that get much media attention in Israel?
No, I think that there's huge awareness that pretty much the United States is the only... seems to be the only unquestioning ally of Israel, and there's an awareness that that relationship could be in jeopardy with the continued rule of Benjamin Netanyahu. That said, that there's a specific comment about how Israel reacts to that, which I'd make, which is that Netanyahu's constituency, he tends to be one which conceives the world from behind the walls of a ghetto. He's a superb rhetorician when it comes to the use of scaremongering and the notion that that even America could be turning its back on Israel as far as his own constituency is concerned, plays to that notion that, you know, Israel has no one else to turn to but it's a, but itself, and in some ways actually consolidates the right wing, the nationalist camp. More generally, I think, you know, what, one of the great eye-openers of the past 2 years has been the extent to which the populations of the region themselves have taken their fate into their own hands, that the degree to which the United States can you know, treat the region as if it was on a as if they were puppets on strings has to some extent has to some extent waned. You've seen, you know, the transformation of political movements and people power determine the fate of and the course of politics in the region, really for a longer period, but at least for the last 2 years. And I don't think to that extent that Israel is an exception to that trend of, you know, the ability of the West to affect the direction of where the region is moving is much, much less than it was a few years ago.
And we can, we have time for one more call on this. Let's go to IE in San Jose. Hi, IE.
Hi.
Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, I think that the cover of the American media of this whole Hegel thing and the election was despicable. New York Times had an awful picture of Hegel hugging or close to Obama. It looked pretty bad, and people can see it in your Facebook or my Facebook page, and very, very disgusting. But what I like to say, of course, Obama have been disappointing in many ways, and that is one of the worst. Supporting Israel, right or wrong, is really not in the good best interest of Israel, because eventually just people are going to get tired of the whole thing, and it, the time is not on the side of Israel. They can go kill all of the Palestinians they can. They can do all kind of crazy, stupid things, but it's going to come and hunt them later on. I give Israel about 10 years, maybe 20 at the latest, with that being as a nation as it is. It probably will just will not accept it. If you Google search the worst brand name in the world, Israel comes in with a flying flying color.
All right.
Thank you. I don't know what to say.
Thank you, Ed. We're just almost out of time with Nicholas. Nicholas, what do you expect to happen after these elections? Netanyahu is expected to win. What do you think will actually change in the coming years from the policies we've seen from him in the past few?
As I started saying right at the start, you're going to see, of course, this consolidation of the right. You're going to see the waning, a growing dichotomy between where the world stands in terms of its perception of the virtual reality of what it would like the final status solution to be, and what the reality on the ground. At the same time, I think you're going to see a growing discussion in Israel as to, well, if you're not having a Palestinian state, if the right is not leading towards a settlement of the conflict along the established lines laid down by the international community, where is it going? And there's going to be increasing kind of questioning as to what happens, what is going to be made of the Palestinian population that remains under under Israeli rule. Mm. And you're going to see increasing discussion as to, you know, is Israel going to be an apartheid state, or is it going to be one which values land over the notion of a jurisdiction state.
Well, and I know we have to let you go, and we'll definitely be following this, and we'll have to do a show. Thank you so much. Nicholas Pelham has covered the Arab world for 20 years. He writes for The Economist and the New York Review of Books. Thank you, Nicholas, for joining us from Jerusalem.
Thank you.
It's your call, and we'll be back after this.
Stories you hear recommended on the Friday Media Roundtable are posted at yourcallradio.org, and they're also included in Your Call's weekly email newsletter. It's free and easy to sign up for. Just click the email newsletter link at yourcallradio.org. And you can highlight the reporting you thought was valuable this week by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or send an email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, it is the inauguration, and we will be carrying the inauguration live. President Obama will be speaking about the giving his speech at 10 o'clock, and then we'll have a special show following that to open up the lines to economic justice activists to get their reaction to the speech. And we will also talk about Martin Luther King's Poor People's Campaign 45 years after this. What is the status of economic justice in the U.S.? That is on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it is our Friday Media Roundtable, the day we speak with reporters about coverage of the week's news. And we are joined by Trevor Aronson, co-director of the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting, author of The Terror Factory, Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terrorism. And we're going to be talking about coverage of internet pioneer and activist Aaron Swartz, who sadly took his life last week at the young age of 26. He was charged by the federal government with computer fraud for using computers at MIT to download millions of academic articles provided by the nonprofit research service JSTOR. He faced up to 35 years in prison. And before we start this and talk about coverage, why don't we play a clip of Aaron Swartz? These were comments made by Aaron regarding JSTOR and scholarly journals he gave at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign in October of 2010 before he was arrested. Here's Aaron Swartz.
I am going to give you one example of something not as big as saving Congress, but something important that you can do right here at your own school. It just requires you willing to get your shoes a little bit muddy. By virtue of being students at a major U.S. university, I assume that you have access to a wide variety of scholarly journals. Pretty much every major university in the United States pays these sort of licensing fees to organizations like JSTOR and Thompson and ISI to get access to scholarly journals that the rest of the world can't read. And these licensing fees are substantial, and they're so substantial that people who are studying in India instead of studying in the United States don't have this kind of access. They're locked out from all of these journals. They're locked out from our entire scientific legacy. I mean, a lot of these journal articles, they go back to the Enlightenment. Every time someone has written down a scientific paper, it's been scanned and digitized and put in these collections. That is a legacy that has been brought to us by the history of people doing interesting work, the history of scientists. It's a legacy that should belong to us as a commons, as a people. But instead, it's been locked up and put online by a handful of for-profit corporations who then try and get the maximum profit they can out of it.
And that is Aaron Swartz speaking in October 2010 at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign before he was arrested. He tragically killed himself last Friday. He was charged by the U.S. government with computer fraud for using computers at MIT to download millions of academic articles from the nonprofit JSTOR. He believed these articles should be accessed by the world. He faced up to 35 years in prison and a $1 million fine. At the age of 14, Aaron Swartz developed Really Simple Syndication, or RSS. This is the key component of so much of the web's publishing infrastructure. At 19, he co-founded a company that merged with Reddit. This is one of the country's most popular websites. And we're talking about media coverage. This has gotten so much media coverage this week with Trevor Aronson. Trevor, first of all, what do you think we need to know about Aaron Swartz? Because so many people didn't even know Aaron before he took his life last Friday.
Right. I mean, obviously, the most important thing to realize is that, you know, the way we consume information online was in so many ways shaped by him. I mean, I think everyone to some degree has used RSS, whether they realize it or not, in how they're consuming news and information. So in many ways, he was this pioneer, even at 26 years of age. I also think it's important to point out that, you know, in the context of this case and his death and the federal charges he was facing, you know, a lot of the media has portrayed this as if he was a computer hacker who hacked into MIT's network and illegally downloaded these articles, when it really isn't that simple. You know, the MIT network was open. The JSTOR service that he downloaded from, he really ultimately just wrote a script that allowed him to download more articles than he was allowed to under the terms of service. So in many ways, this should have been a civil case. This was an example of him violating the agreement of the terms of service. But even though JSTOR didn't want him indicted, this is something that the federal government took very seriously for reasons that we don't fully understand, and wanted to prosecute him as a felon.
And so JSTOR and MIT decided not to press charges, right?
That's right. It was something that the federal government chose to pursue. What we don't know is why he wanted these articles. Mm. You know, the clip you played, which people have been talking about, suggests that he was interested in kind of freeing these articles and this base of knowledge from JSTOR and allowing other you know, people in other countries in the developing world that are financially unable to access this information to give them access to some degree. But it's also true that, you know, earlier he had, he had researched academic articles to look for patterns, you know, for example, looking for particular foundations that were funding academic research to see if there was flaws in that research. And, you know, this may have been something as simple as a research project that he had going on. It's unclear that he wanted to necessarily use this for any commercial reason, and certainly unclear if he, you know, intended to violate copyrights in any way by downloading these stories, these articles.
His family released a statement saying, quote, Aaron's death is not simply a personal tragedy. It is the product of a criminal justice system rife with intimidation and prosecutorial overreach. And I was reading articles by lawyers this morning, and Orrin Kerr, professor of law at George Washington University, writing at the Volokh conspiracy website, wrote, quote, if you want to end these tactics, don't just complain about the Swartz case. Instead, complain that this is business as usual in federal criminal cases around the country, mostly with defendants who no one has ever heard of and who get locked up for years without anyone else much caring. End quote. So can you talk a little bit about this? Again, computer fraud, he faced 35 years in jail, $1 million fine. What were the charges exactly? And when did the feds decide to go after him?
Right. This started 2 years ago, and they charged him with essentially computer fraud, as if he, had intentionally hacked into a server that he wasn't allowed access to, you know, essentially the digital version of breaking and entering, so to speak. And I think what's important to realize here is, you know, the kind of unchecked power that federal prosecutors have to some degree. You know, the percentage of cases and people that plead guilty in federal court is well over 90%. There are mandatory minimums and sentencing guidelines that at times seem absolutely draconian. Like, as you mentioned, I believe in Aaron's case, he was facing up to 35 years in prison. And so it really puts people who are facing federal charges at a terrible disadvantage. You know, if they choose to go to trial, the government has a history of winning more than 9 in 10 cases. And then if you lose, you're facing decades in prison. And I think this gives enormous power to prosecutors. And what we're seeing is, you know, at times what you mentioned, this concern about dubious cases being brought into the courts involving defendants who people have never heard of. You know, in my research, I mean, this dovetails nicely into, you know, when you look at terrorism cases, the people that are charged with terrorism and face 30 years in prison,
right,
are in many ways people that were incapable of terrorism and people that, you know, no one has ever heard of much, fewer people have heard of than Aaron Swartz, for example. But I think, you know, someone like Aaron, you know, is facing, you know, enormous odds in beating a charge like this, just given the track record that federal prosecutors have in winning cases in federal court.
That is Trevor Aronson. He's co-director of the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting, author of the new book, The Terror Factory, Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terrorism. And in the coming weeks, we'll be speaking with Trevor specifically about his book and what he found about the FBI going after these cases. And this story has gotten a lot of attention. I'm sure a lot of you have heard Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! Extensively covering this. So what are your thoughts about what this reveals about the cases the FBI or the DOJ and the FBI decide to pursue? And what does this mean about information and access to information? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What strikes you about this case and the media coverage of it? And then also, if you saw a story out there that you'd like to talk about that you think deserves more attention, we'd love to hear from you. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. You can also leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So, Trevor, why don't you talk a little bit about the media coverage? Because this has been covered widely from every outlet, from Democracy Now! To Forbes magazine.
Right. I think this is a story that in so many ways crosses the traditional boundaries of media. You know, it's a story that's about business. It's a story that's about, you know, the activist community and the hacktivist community. And it's also a story about kind of government overreach and potential prosecutorial misconduct. And so for that reason, I think we've seen a various amount of coverage about it, some of it more nuanced than others. In other cases, you know, I think, you know, places like Democracy Now!, for example, which have really held up a torch on this, have implied that this was retribution for Aaron's comments in Illinois and this the perceived feeling that he wanted to free this information. And I don't think that's fully been proven. And I think there's a lot of unanswered questions. I mean, I think part of the problem is that we don't fully know what he wanted to do with all of the articles he was downloading. You know, we can certainly speculate about that. But I also think, you know, one of the things that hasn't really been talked about is that even though JSTOR came out and said, you know, we don't really feel that he should be prosecuted for this, you know, JSTOR is a really interesting system, and the whole academic database system is interesting in the sense that, you know, most academics write these articles for free, or if they get compensated very little. And then in turn, the universities they work for have to pay handsome royalty fees to JSTOR and other academic databases to access other people's academic work, which those people weren't paid for either. And so you can see from, you know, the idea of, you know, the internet making things more efficient and being a disruptive force, something like this, you know, freeing academic research and making it more accessible to more people is certainly something that you would expect to have been disrupted by the internet, but it's not been. There's been a real protection of these types of databases where this type of information that should be freely accessible, and I think most of the authors of these articles would like it to be freely accessible because, you know, academics ultimately want more people to read their work, want more people to cite that work, are in turn, because of these databases, having smaller and smaller audiences, and in turn aren't even making much money, if any money, from these efforts.
Right, and a number of academics wanted to make a point by having a sort of open access tribute to Aaron. So academics from around the world posted their research online for free to pay tribute to them. There were more than almost 300,000. I'm sure 30,000. I'm sure it's gone up since last week.
Right. And I think maybe this is the time that we can start to, you know, it'd be nice to see the academic community talking more about this and trying to think of alternatives to things like JSTOR. I mean, there's no reason that you can't make a freely accessible database of journal articles online that's even more sophisticated than the search functions in JSTOR. But it's a matter of kind of breaking up that system where, and you have obviously a lot of money involved among the people that are running these companies that administer the databases.
And I guess the other question, again, is just why the feds would go after this guy, go after Aaron Swartz in such a harsh way. I mean, 35 years in prison, and you're talking about a 26-year-old and a possible $1 million fine. There is a petition at the White House website to remove the federal prosecutor, Carmen Ortiz, who charged Aaron Swartz. Within 3 days, the petition received more than 25,000 signatures, and that's what was needed for the Obama administration to actually address the issue and make a statement. The petition was then taken down after it gained over 33,000 signatures. And then the White House has since changed its policy. They're now requiring a petition with 100,000 signatures. And as of this morning, the petition has 43,000. So this raises other questions. Do you think the White House changed their tune because of this petition?
It's hard to say. I mean, the circumstances certainly sound that. I mean, certainly sounds like they changed the rules, you know, in the middle of the game. I also think it's worth noting, you know, that in many ways the federal government works like a bureaucracy because it is one. And so, you know, so much money has been poured into in the investigation of cyber crimes and cyber terrorism that, you know, there's a real kind of bureaucratic incentive to pursue these cases because there's so much money being allocated to their pursuit. And so it becomes kind of a dog wagging the tail, a tail wagging the dog situation.
Right. Well, and do you think the media attention is what might bring about changes to what many consider to be outdated and archaic laws? For example, Aaron's Law has been introduced by California Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren, which would make changes to computer fraud laws making it no longer illegal to breach these kinds to breach a contract like this.
Absolutely, you know, and it's kind of obviously tragic that it would take something like this to have a law be introduced and have it gain that much attention. But it seems like this has reached such a critical point and there's so much attention on it that I find it hard to believe that it wouldn't gain at least some support. And at the very least, I think it's beginning to get people to talk about, you know, whether we are using, you know, these old systems and thinking about, you know, academic research and the free availability of information, whether we should think about those things in different ways now that the internet is here. I mean, why are we continuing to use these database programs that were, you know, designed back when not everyone had access to the internet? And now that access is freely available to everyone, why aren't we moving more in that direction? And I think it certainly raises questions about, you know, and then maybe this will be something that will ultimately be investigated. I mean, this strikes me as a civil case. You know, this was Aaron violating the terms of service on JSTOR, and the federal government pursued him for that. I mean, I think it's not that much different from, you know, unlocking your iPhone and having the federal government come after you for that reason, just because you violated the terms of service with Apple in that case.
And are the media asking the questions that you raise in your reports and your new book, The Terror Factory, about how the feds decide which cases to pursue and who they choose to go after?
Not so far. I mean, I think the question is, you know, what we have seen is a real escalation in the amount of money that's been allocated to the FBI and DOJ in the pursuit of cybercrimes and cyber terrorism. And we haven't quite seen the net effects of that yet because it's still a little early. You know, what we can say is we've seen the net effects of that in terrorism. You know, you obviously increase the amount of money available to the prosecution of terrorism, you end up getting a lot more terrorism cases. And so now what we may be seeing is more of these cybercrimes cases as a result of the available money to the government. And, you know, it's possible that Aaron is kind of on the vanguard of that, and on the unfortunate vanguard, that Aaron was one of the first to be, you know, swept up in this new kind of focus that the federal government has on cybercrimes and cyber terrorism.
What questions do you think the media should be asking right now as this case still gets attention?
You know, I mean, I think the one question is how far up this went. You know, was this something that was decided at the local U.S. Attorney's office, or did the DOJ and D.C. approve it, and then how far up did it go? You know, the same with the people investigating it. And also, you know, I think the question to the federal government is, you know, the law is supposed to be here to remedy, to make us whole, right? So in this case, if JSTOR says they were okay with it and MIT says they were okay with it, you know, who did Aaron really harm? And in that case, why did the federal government feel it necessary to pursue criminal charges when it doesn't seem there really was an aggrieved party in this case?
That is Trevor Aronson. He's co-director of the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting, author of the new book, The Terror Factory, Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terrorism. And we're planning to interview Trevor soon about his book, specifically to talk about the information he uncovered. And we've got just about 6 or so minutes left. If you'd like to weigh in on this really important case, the tragic suicide of Aaron Swartz last Friday. He was charged with computer fraud by the federal government after he downloaded documents from JSTOR at MIT. Again, both MIT and JSTOR refused to press charges. What are your thoughts on this? It's gotten a lot of media attention. Do you think the media are asking the right questions and really raising the points that Trevor is raising when you're talking about who the feds decide to go after and what cases they decide to pursue? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Also, this case does raise a lot of important questions about access to information. Let's hear from Jim in Marinwood. Hi, Jim. Welcome to the show. Hi, Jim. Hello, Jim. Let's try Frank in San Francisco. Hi, Frank.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
One quick point. First of all, I'm completely sympathetic with open access to information, and I feel really bad about Jason's suicide. He's actually from the same town where I grew up.
Oh, it's Aaron.
Sorry.
No, that's Aaron. Okay. You were thinking JSTOR.
Yeah. One point I want to make, though, is that the peer-reviewed journal process is expensive, and that's because the author submits an article to the journal. The journal has to find peers in this academic community, send it out to them for review. They send it back. The original author gets it back, changes the research, and the process iterates. So I'm not sympathetic to Elsevier or any of the journals that charge a lot of money, but I just want to point out that it's not a question of just publishing these journals. They submit it and then it's published. There is a significant cost involved to the peer-reviewed journal process. That should just be made aware of.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, it's a good point. Trevor, your thoughts on that?
I mean, I think that's true. I think I'm not necessarily advocating that any of this or making the claim that these databases are free to run and free to maintain or even free in the peer process. But I think, you know, in many cases, the academics who produce this research, you know, research component is a big part of their job at the university. And so I think there should be a way to set up a collective almost where the universities are able to subsidize these databases by paying their professors who ultimately become the peers on these review panels. I mean, obviously there has to be a way for something like JSTOR or an academic database of some kind, even if it's available online, to sustain itself. And maybe that can be done through foundation support or others. But I think the kind of the lockdown approach that we currently have that Aaron was researching is something that should and could change in the future.
All right. Thank you for calling in, Jim, or I'm sorry, Frank. Let's hear next from Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg.
Hello. Just a couple of comments, I guess. One, I just want to say that I'm really appalled by some of the comments that I heard out of the federal prosecutor who was involved in this case with regard to Mr. Schwartz. I couldn't believe how callous they were. And this is a little bit maybe a stretch, but when people are asking why the government would do this, it's clear that apparently large sections of the government, whether it's federal or even state, are relatively paranoid about any kind of information that they don't want to get out. And I just want to focus maybe attention on one thing. I've just been reviewing or replaying the movie JFK. If anybody wants to see what the government is really up to and get an insight into what goes on, I would suggest people go back and get that DVD and look at it. You'll get an idea of what the government will and can do they feel like they want to do something about something, a situation like this.
All right. Well, thank you. And Trevor, I'm just looking at your Twitter account right now, and you've got some really interesting facts. And I'm sure this is in your book, and we're looking forward to having you back to talk about your book. But you tweet that the FBI, and this is according to your book, the FBI has created 150 plots since 9/11, leading to prosecutions. Its counterterrorism budget is $3 billion per year. Also, the FBI has 10 times more informants than it did 40 years ago. What other factoids did you uncover in doing your research that we should know about?
Yeah, you know, I mean, a big part of my book discusses the role that informants, who are often, you know, coerced into cooperation by, you know, either criminal charges hanging over them or through the threat of deportation, the role that they play in federal prosecutions, particularly for terrorism. You know, if you look at the more than 500 cases that the terrorism cases that came through the courts since 9/11, you know, one in two involved an informant, and in many cases the informant played a kind of agent provocateur where he provided the means and the opportunity for, you know, people who left to their own devices had no capacity, but the FBI informant or the undercover agent provides, you know, the bomb and everything they need to overnight become terrorists, so to speak.
And what is it like gathering this kind of information? What was that process like for you?
You know, the information is out there. It's just hard to put it all together because, you know, you have to sort through thousands of pages of court records in every single case. You know, the use of an informant isn't something that the FBI or the DOJ necessarily advertises. So you'll see it buried in reports or in affidavits. And it really is a time-consuming task in making all of this information available. And obviously, I think that's something that the government does intentionally. You know, they intentionally make it difficult to go through this information. The information is available. It's a court record, so it has to be public. But at the same time, the government, you know, throws so much paperwork into it that it makes this type of research very difficult. But also, I think very important because it's important to understand, you know, how billions of dollars being spent by the FBI is influencing its decision to pursue terrorism cases. And at the same time, the role that informants who, you know, have some at times incentive in the prosecution, the role that they play in inducing people to you know, who are on the edge to come forward and say they want to commit some sort of act of terrorism.
We have an interesting email from Michael who says, one might wonder how the federal government viewed Mr. Swartz's case in light of the ongoing prosecution of Bradley Manning. Might the government have felt that if it let Swartz off, its case against Manning might be affected? And Bradley Manning is the U.S. Army private who is accused of leaking documents, State Department cables, and the collateral murder video to WikiLeaks. What are your thoughts on his email?
I mean, it's an interesting idea. I think it's important to point out that, you know, in the case of Bradley Manning, you know, this was someone who was employed by the U.S. military, realized that the information he was leaking was confidential and that he was violating State Secrets Act by doing that, or allegedly violating that. In the case of Aaron Schwartz, you know, there was no such agreement. The only agreement he had in place was the terms of service that he agreed to with JSTOR that said he's only allowed to download so many documents. So I think, you know, the case against Schwartz is far less strong than the case against Bradley Manning for that reason.
And again, Bradley Manning arrested in May 2010 in Iraq. And in our final minute, in terms of, you know, how has this changed under the Obama administration? How is it different from what you've seen and just the research you found doing this compared to past administrations?
You know, one thing that's important to point out along these lines is we've seen an explosion of warrantless wiretapping and surveillance, and particularly computer surveillance under Obama. You know, we didn't see a lot of that under the Bush administration. Mm-hmm. And since Obama, we've seen an explosion of warrantless wiretaps. The ACLU on its national website has done a good job of kind of collecting that information. And I think it's important to remember that the government under Obama has been so concerned about using surveillance and computer surveillance that, you know, in the case of Petraeus, it ended up, you know, sinking the CIA director. I mean, that's how unchecked the government powers have become in being able to use computer surveillance, being able to get access to email accounts. And I think that these types of cases are only going to increase under Obama.
Well, and this is why investigative reporting is so important. And Trevor, we look forward to having you back to talk specifically more about your book. Trevor Aronson is co-director of the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting, author of The Terror Factory: Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terrorism. Thank you so much, Trevor.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for your emails and phone calls. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. And here's what's coming up on Monday. What's the state of Martin Luther King's dream in 2013? On the next Your Call, following the presidential inauguration at 10, we'll get reaction from economic justice advocates. Will President Obama mention poverty and inequality in his speech? What's the status of economic justice 45 years after the Poor People's Campaign? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What will it take to seriously address economic disparities in this country? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on, and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.